right, welcome to episode number 11 of the Angels Cup Coffee Hunters podcast. Today I'm speaking with Devin Chapman. Hey Devin, how you doing?
Good, how's it going?
Great. So Devin has an incredible background in the coffee business. He's worked for three of our favorite roasters, including Coava, Verve, and La Coulombe. He's also had an incredible run as a competitor in a lot of different coffee competitions. I'm just going to read through his list of achievements here. Starting in 2011, he won the Northwest Regional Brewers Cup. He was the Northwest Regional Brewers Cup champion. In 2011 again, he was the United States Barista Championship semifinalist. 2012, Northwest Regional Brewers Cup champion. 2012, Northwest Regional Barista champion. 2012, fourth place in the U.S. Barista Championship. 2013, Northwest Regional Barista champion. 2015, fifth place in the U.S. Barista Championship. And 2016, this year, third place in the U.S. Barista Championship. He's also now working for a bakery called Tartine, and he's working on launching a coffee roasting operation within Tartine called The Manufactory. Okay, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Super excited to be here.
Okay, so our first question, which we ask to most of our guests, is do you remember your first cup of coffee?
Yeah, so the first cup, I mean, I drank coffee sort of my whole life. In various forms, milk, sugar, with very little thought or purpose. And it wasn't until 2003, I had a cup of coffee at the Stumptown Cafe on Belmont in Portland, Oregon, that it was the first time I really interacted with intentionally sourced and roasted and brewed coffee, and it was a huge eye-opening experience for me. I think I was probably 18 or 19. I don't remember much of anybody who served it. I don't much remember much about it, what coffee it was or anything like that. I just remember I tasted this coffee and was like, oh my God, what is this? And that kind of sparked a huge fascination and borderline obsession, I would say, with coffee.
2003, were you still in college then? Where were you?
Yeah, 2003, I had just moved to Portland for school.
Okay. And then it looks like your first job was working with the Portland Rescue Mission.
That's right, yeah. So I my first job out of school, I had studied educational psychology, curriculum program development, as well as intercultural studies and a few other things. And so I got this job working at Portland Rescue Mission where I was working in the volunteer department, so I was actively recruiting, placing, training, and following up with volunteers that would come in to work, that would volunteer with our organization, as well as developing curriculum surrounding sort of getting them integrated with our programs and with our clients and all that stuff. And the Portland Rescue Mission does homeless outreach to men, women in the Portland area, as well as drug and alcohol recovery for men as well. So, you know, it's a pretty intense community, I would say. And, you know, I really enjoyed the time I was there, you know, learning and figuring out how to integrate people off the street who wanted to sort of or people that were coming in to volunteer that wanted to give and wanted to learn and wanted to serve, and helping them sort of get accustomed, get acclimatized, and learn a little bit about the culture of people that we were working with.
Before we move into coffee, do you have any particularly interesting stories of people you met while you were there?
I mean, I definitely there were times where I would be interacting with guys in the program and seeing the way that they're kind of, you know, understanding a little bit about their background and understanding a little bit about their kind of where they come from and the rough environments that they grew up in and the things that resulted in their addiction or their issues, and seeing how, like, just a bit of engagement and a bit of sort of asking the right questions and a bit of active care could go a long way and could really, like, transform, not just transform the way that people see the world, but transform the way that that they actually see themselves and behave. I mean, there was some pretty amazing stuff happened.
Did you end up staying in touch with anyone you met there?
I'm still in touch with a few people, yeah, which is cool.
People like coworkers or people like individuals who were homeless who came in seeking help?
Both, yeah. There's a guy who I connected with who, you know, we'd play music, because I play music, and we would play music and hang out, and yeah, he's still still doing well. And, you know, addiction is a tough thing, and it's like, it's really hard. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of these guys had come in and had sort of burned every, you know, bridge, road, and rope that they had, and to see them kind of rebuild that and start to like build a new life. It's pretty cool.
So he was homeless, or he had an addiction problem?
He had an addiction problem and was couch surfing and was sort of all over the place. You know,
what was he addicted to?
Heroin.
Okay.
Among other things. It's usually not one thing. It's usually, I mean, heroin is usually the one that kind of takes the cake, because mm-hmm. that's the most debilitating generally, but, or can be,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, heroin.
And so he's been straight and clean for.
Yeah. As far as I know.
So what made you decide to leave that and enter the world of coffee?
I came to a point where I kind of wanted to transition out of working in the nonprofit world into working in the business world, the mm-hmm. for-profit world. You know, I won't necessarily go into details, but I wanted to be able to do something that was generating its own revenue in order to be able to kind of have the ability to keep doing it without having to ask people to give us money or sort of be dependent on that. So I left, I think at the very beginning of 2010, I left the Portland Rescue Mission and was doing a bit of consulting and a bit of some just curriculum design work, and picked up a supplement job working at a bakery in Portland making coffee. And I was only there a short amount of time before I ended up meeting the owners of Kova, which was starting up right around that same time, and ended up getting a job coming in the ground level with them as the first employee there. And that's kind of what kickstarted my whole coffee career. But it was almost, and it's funny, you talk to a lot of coffee professionals, you know, people that are super deep in the coffee world, like oftentimes it is by accident. You know, you start working at a cafe and then because you're interested in coffee, and then you start to see kind of the how deep and how impactful and how much potential there is in the global coffee industry, and we kind of get hooked. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely what happened to me.
So you were the first employee at Kova?
Yeah, so I came in right when they were opening. I mean, Kova had been roasting since like 2007, 2008 out of a garage, but they had opened their space. They were opening their space in 2010, July of 2010, and I came in June of 2010 before they opened the space. And yeah, for the first, you know, for the first few months we were there, it was just me and the two owners.
What was that? Have I been saying their name wrong? I've been calling them Kova. I guess
it's Kova. It is Kova. Kova is probably the more popular term. I mean, I think more people probably say that, but Kova is definitely the word.
Okay.
And anyways, yeah. So it was I mean, honestly, it was an incredible opportunity. I would not be where I am in my career if I didn't kind of happen upon that opportunity.
Uh-huh.
And I say that, you know, very, very, very wholeheartedly. And, you know, in the early days of Kova, we were doing a few different things. We were obviously roasting coffee and serving it in this retail environment. But we were also working on sort of developing the cone, which was born out of Kova. The cone, like stainless steel metal filter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember in the first few months, I spent hours and hours and hours just brewing coffee, testing out these cone filters, you know, working alongside one of the owners named Keith, you know, just learning about how coffee works, learning about extraction, learning about taste and flavor, you know. And I've always been the type of person who, you know, when I'm interested in something, I'm 110%. And it was sort of the like most fortuitous environment for me to be in in order to learn and grow at a very quick rate. And I mean, we brewed so much coffee in those early days, kind of developing this filter. And, you know, that was an incredible opportunity for anybody. You know, I think coming in as the sort of the solo employee amongst the owners also meant that as they started to get pulled away to focus on other things, as, you know, roasting volumes went up and as, you know, blah, 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 it opened up opportunities for me to maybe step into a little bit more responsibility at a more accelerated rate. So, right. You know, for me, once again, based on my personality, that was an extreme challenge for me to get as good and as knowledgeable and as sort of dialed as possible as quickly as I could. And so those early, you know, the first 6 months or so at Cova was this like very intense incubation period for me to really learn as much as I could in a very, very short amount of time, mm-hmm. with almost any resource I wanted at my fingertips. And so, you know, I look at it as, you know, it's a humbling thing to know that like I was at the right place at the right time and met the right people, and that kind of kickstarted this whole thing.
So that was like a crash course in palate training for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was a crash course in palate training. It was a crash course in advanced barista training. It was a crash course in hospitality. It was a crash course in everything. And, you know, I was just, at the time, it was just perfect for what I was looking for. Because I was, you know, like as I mentioned, I was very, very interested in coffee and I was borderline obsessed with it. And now I'm working at this place behind this beautiful bar where people are coming in and expecting, you know, the best of the best. And I was responsible for that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I never wanted to pass anything across the counter that I didn't feel like was a reflection of the best of the best. And so anytime I would like struggle or anytime I would feel, you know, like I was not up to snuff, I would just push myself that much harder to get better and better and better. So it was like, couldn't have been a better environment for me to learn.
Sounds like it sounds like a great experience. And then after that, you moved to Verve, and then after that to La Colombe. So it seems like you sort of moved up in terms of size.
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. I was at Cova for a good amount of time and, you know, experienced a lot of stuff there. Wanted to sort of step into a larger market, mm-hmm. and had the opportunity to go to New York with Verve. Verve did like a 3-month pop-up in Williamsburg in the end of 2013. And so I had the opportunity to go out and do that, which kind of got me a foot in the door with Verve. And then they were getting ready to expand to Los Angeles and open cafes there. And they offered me a cafe manager position to go and sort of begin the process of building that with the team in LA. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I would say like from there to La Colombe as well, each step was bigger and bigger, you know, which is cool. I love the fact that I've worked for, you know, companies with 3 employees and I've worked for companies with hundreds of employees, you know, because I feel like each company brings its own strength and weakness, or not weakness. Each company brings its own sort of like there's good things that come along with having size, and there's good things that coming. There's good things that come along with being like a larger size and having like a deep impact or like a larger reach. And there's good things about being kind of a small and nimble roasting company as well.
So let's dig into that for a second. Yeah. What are the good things that come from being big, and what are the good things that come from being small?
I think a major advantage of being big is that you have a large, you know, you have a large audience, you have a large customer base, like you're moving a lot of coffee, and the opportunity for you to impact with quality or with the stories of the coffees or, you know, connecting people to the supply chain is, you know, it's just a matter of mathematics. It's like you just have more people that are buying your coffee, that are drinking your coffee. You know, you have more reach, even in supply chain. It's easier to kind of control costs when you're moving large amounts, which can help you know, obviously drive your business, and the potential for impact in supply chain. So, you know, working with farmers or working with organizations that are in places, you know, like East Africa or Central America or Haiti, your potential for impact is that much higher. I mean, you're dealing with, you have more capital, you have more volume and more potential impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, Loc Alom, for example, did things all over the place in Africa, in Haiti, you know, partnering with big organizations that knew the brand and wanted to work with them and have done incredible things. I mean, you know, Loc Alom, I mean, they own and help operate farms in Haiti that are, I mean, it's legendary for the Haitian people. You know, it's that type of impact. You can't do that with, you know, if you're only moving, you know, 3,000 pounds of coffee a week. So, you know, it's pretty cool. The other side of the coin, you know, with the smaller roasters is you have the ability to be very nimble and very focused, and your quality control is just, you know, it's easier to kind of wrap your hands around. You know, if you have, you know, one or two cafes in one city, obviously it's going to be easier to manage the quality versus having 20 cafes in five cities across the country. So I think that that's one advantage that a small roaster has. I think another one is, you know, there's these, oftentimes you'll come upon these like micro lot coffees that are separations from these small farms that are only producing maybe, you know, these micro lots may only have like 4 to 10 bags of green coffee, you know, which isn't that much. A large company is going to blow through that in a half a week versus a smaller roaster being able to sort of, you know, have that coffee and have that offering for, you know, 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the offerings can sometimes, you know, at a small roaster, you oftentimes can have the opportunity to offer these like super small micro lot coffees that you wouldn't necessarily be able to have if you were a bigger roaster. Now, that's not necessarily hard and fast. Like, I know that there are big roasters that are getting micro lots and pushing them out, but, you know, with that small size, like anything, you're just very nimble.
Which big roasters are getting those micro lots and pushing them out?
I mean, I would say that there's a lot. I mean, I know Loc Alom is working with, they have their whole workshop line that's focusing on smaller sort of micro lot coffees. Intelli has the micro lots that they're able to source and push. You know, Verve, I would say, is somewhere in the middle, but they definitely are sourcing some super, super high-end, like very boutique, small lot coffees, beautiful coffees. And so I would say, I mean, all of the big roasters, for the most part, that want to stay relevant in the sort of current coffee environment are doing that or starting to, which I think is a great thing. You know, but then you have places like Kova, who you can almost look at their entire offering sheet and say, all of these are sort of these micro lot coffees for the most part, you know, with some exceptions. But
so I think next we're going to start moving into the competitive portion of your career.
Yeah.
You actually started competing pretty soon. You got your first job working at Quavo. That was 2010.
Yeah.
And then you competed in 2011.
Yeah, there was like, it was like 6 months.
Okay.
So. It was pretty quick.
Yeah. What I guess originally got you interested in competing?
I think for me, like, as I've mentioned before, my personality is sort of go 110% as fast as I can, right? So understanding that there was this competition environment, or this competition that existed, I was able to sort of look at that and say, cool, like, I really want to do that. And you know, there's only one way to really do it, and that's to just sign up and do it. And oftentimes I think people undervalue the learning opportunity of, you know, maybe not being quite, quote unquote, there or ready. And so choosing not to compete versus just like throwing yourself in and learning. I mean, I mentioned that initial 6 month period at Kova was like such a learning experience. I think you know, once I did my first competition and sort of went through that process, you know, that too was an accelerated learning experience. Like I started looking at espresso different. I started looking at coffee different. I started looking at the way that I talked and thought and expressed, my passion for coffee differently. And, you know, it really started to inform, the retail program that we were setting up at Kova. And it laid a foundation of things that I still sort of am building on today. And so I think, you know, once again, I kind of just chalk it up to being at I was at Kova and they were super supportive of me being involved in competition, despite the fact that I had been a barista for all of about 6 months and I had the opportunity to kind of throw myself in. And to be fair, I mean, I did really well that first year. And, you know, I mean, not a lot of people can say that they, you know, signed up for a competition within a 6 month period of being in the coffee industry and they actually won something. So, you know, once again, like winning the Brewers Cup in 2011, that was January 2011. Winning the Brewers Cup then was such a shock and it was so amazing. And once again, I chalk it up to just like, I had spent so many hours just brewing and tasting coffees. And, you know, it was the early days of the Brewers. It was actually the first year of the Brewers Cup that year. And so I think that kind of lent itself a little bit to, you know, being a fortunate opportunity for me. But
did you use that cone device in the Brewers Cup competition?
Yeah, I did. I used it the first year, yeah. Which is cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
It was exciting. And I think too, you know, the first regional competition, I didn't make finals. That was back when they had finals in the regionals. I didn't make finals. I finished like 10th overall. And I remember being so bummed. Like I was so bummed. And I had made the finals in the Brewers Cup. And so I remember I took that sort of like that feeling of like being disappointed in myself or being let down. And I just like decided I'm going to just put myself all into this competition, this finals presentation for this coffee for the Brewers Cup. And then, you know, I ended up winning, which was rad. Also worth noting with regards to that. So, because I won the Brewers Cup in 2011, it got me a free trip to Houston. And that's the thing that enabled me to actually compete at the US barista competition as well. So because I had the free trip to Houston, it meant that I got to put together another competition routine and got to go through that whole process again for USBC. And I went to USBC thinking, you know, if I could make semifinals, I'll be happy. And I made semifinals and I was really happy. So it was great.
Awesome. It was really great. Is the first time we've had Brewers Cup competitors on the show before. We never actually had a barista championship competitor. So can you walk us through what the US Barista Championship is and how it works and sort of what you're doing when you're on stage?
Absolutely. So the US Barista Competition, and this is like the US Barista Competition is connected to the World Barista Competition. So the World Barista Competition is, you know, one competitor from every nation competes for the World Barista Championship place. And so that the US competition is informed largely by the world competition. But the general format is you have, basically you're provided a espresso machine and a grinder and three tables. And you have a 15-minute period, you have 15 minutes to prepare three courses for four judges. So you prepare an espresso course, a milk beverage course, and a signature beverage course. Now, what you are required to do as a competitor, if you want to do well, is you are required to sort of somehow or another create more value in that 15 minutes than just the sum of those three drinks. So you're telling a story about a farmer, you're telling a story about a coffee, you're telling a story about, you know, your job or your what you've learned or whatever. I mean, it's you can say anything that you want, really. Mm-hmm. And everything has to connect both to the coffee and to you as a barista. And you have to demonstrate coffee knowledge. You have to demonstrate professionalism, attention to detail, and an ability to make really good coffee and accurately describe it to these judges. And so, yeah, I mean, it sounds fairly straightforward, but, you know, I think there's competitors that spend 6 months locked in a lab getting ready for this to, like, be able to most properly articulate exactly what they want to articulate and, mm-hmm. and make sure that they're that they understand both understand their coffee and understand sort of the point of view and the point that they're trying to express. I mean, it's a wonderful. It's just a wonderful thing for some people. For others, it's, you know, not. But I mean, for those of us that have done it,
How is the judging done? It's not just based on the quality of the drinks you present; it's based on the quality of the presentation.
Yes. Yes. So you're judged on for each course, you're judged on taste balance. So, you know, a balance of sweet, acidic, and bitter in the cup. You're also judged on flavor. So you're required to give sort of flavor notes. It's going to taste like, you know, Applejacks and whatever, and mm-hmm. you're judged on the accuracy of those flavor descriptors. And then with espresso, there's a tactile balance score. With the milk beverage, there's a few like visual scores. And then signature beverage is like you make whatever you want to make using, like, there's no rules for that course, except for it has to be something that you can drink and mm-hmm. it has to have a shot of espresso in it and it can't have any alcohol. So you can really do anything that you want with that, but you have to be able to explain what's in it, why you made it that way, how the flavors or the ingredients you use connect to the flavors in the coffee. I mean, really, it's like you thoroughly have to connect everything, and there can't be any sort of – there can't be any like T uncrossed or I undotted. I mean, it's very, very, very thorough. And so you're judged on those things as far as taste and flavor, and then you're also judged on your professionalism, your knowledge of coffee, your ability to make coffee. Obviously, that you have four sensory judges that are judging all of your drinks, and then you have tech judges that are watching every single movement that you make and, like, you know, if you spill a little bit of coffee, they're going to mark you down. And if you do, you know, three movements and one of them is slightly different than the other, then they're going to mark you down. I mean, it's like, it's so, so, so intense. I mean, it's also incredibly fun. I mean, and it's incredibly challenging. And you know, for baristas, it pushes us to be better and to apply that same sort of mentality and thought and focus in our everyday jobs.
Are there any baristas who turn this into, like, a magic show?
That's so funny that you mentioned that. Me and one of my good friends have talked about doing, like a barista magician routine, but only in jokes. But yeah, I mean, there's really, as far as magic show, you're really tied to the score sheets. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you cannot mm-hmm. drift too far from what you're evaluated on. And so what that does for those that want to be successful, like, you really have to dig into the score sheets and you mm-hmm. really have to dig into, like, understanding what the judges are looking for. And that will really kind of control the content to a certain extent, which kind of keeps things a little bit grounded. Mm-hmm. And really, honestly, I mean, that really pushes, like, for myself, that pushes me to be more creative with how I can play within that score sheet, but still, you know, have a point of view or have a platform to say something meaningful and impactful that will kind of reverberate throughout the industry.
Because mm-hmm. part of it is also being entertaining, right? Is that not on the score sheet?
To be honest, like, you can have, like, entertainment is, I think it ties into everything, but uh-huh. But really, I mean, you're judged on your ability to make coffee, your ability to be an ambassador of specialty coffee, to demonstrate coffee knowledge. And so, like, do the sort of engaging, like, vibrant personalities stand out on the competition stage? Like, I definitely think they do. But do they always win? No, they don't. Because at the end of the day, it's not necessarily about personality as much as it is about your ability to be a coffee professional, make really good coffee, you know, have that coffee taste the way that you say it's going to taste, and really demonstrate a mastery level over manipulation of coffee. And so, you know, it's cool. I think one thing that I always appreciate about the competition, you know, in the 5-6 years I've been doing it, is that it's constantly evolving. Like, they're trying to continuously make it better and better and better, and continuously make it as far as, you know, at the end of every year, like, whoever takes home that World Barista Championship crown, really being sure that they are truly like the best ambassador for specialty coffee for the next, for that year. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's not an easy task, you know, in any regard, but yeah, it's cool to see that they're always trying to kind of refine it and make it better and better.
Mm-hmm. In 2016, what was your signature beverage?
2016. So 2016, I used two coffees. I used like a super, super high end, Colombian micro lot called El Faldon from Huila. And I used, a coffee from Brazil, like more approachable sort of, everyday coffee. And I wanted to use the Brazil for my signature drink, but use sort of ingredients to kind of transform it from, you know, that sort of round approachable profile to something that was fit for the, what I described as the coffee elite. And so what I did was, I took crystallized rainforest honey and muddled it with variegated lemon peel. So variegated lemons are pink lemons. So I like muddled it with the lemon peels and then diluted it with hot water, or rinsed it with hot water, and combined that with espresso. And so it was like a, it had a bit of like citrus, like a interesting kind of tropical citrus flavor to it. It was sweet from the honey, but it was also like very complex and interesting, and yeah, it was great. So it was kind of like the ultimate inspiration for that drink was this old sort of cocktail punch base called Oleosaccharum, where they would use tea, lemon, like citrus peel and sugar to create this like simple syrup type of base, and then they would make these like cocktail punches with them. That was like the initial sort of inspiration for that technique. But yeah, it was good. I mean, it was a really tasty drink.
That's interesting. So the goal was to make the espresso, the Brazilian espresso, taste like the Colombian?
It wasn't necessarily to make it taste like the Colombian, but it was taking like the things that the coffee elite love about super complex, vibrant, tropical coffees like that Colombian, and saying, you know, I can use these simple techniques to kind of recreate this experience using this, you know, widely available coffee.
Cool.
Yeah. So it wasn't, I wasn't saying like, I want this Brazil to taste like this Colombia. It was saying this Colombia has these attributes and I want to recreate these attributes using this Brazil.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. And so can you talk to us about what you have personally learned? You mentioned earlier on that when you first started competing in these things, you learned a lot. Can you talk about what you've learned and what you've taken away from being a competitor?
I think the biggest thing that I've learned in the process of competing is that, you know, competition puts you in a scenario where you have to fully own every single thing you're doing. So everything that you say, every movement that you make, you know, everybody's watching, people are watching it. And if it's unintentional, people are going to notice. If it's intentional, people are going to notice. And I think, you know, the biggest thing for me is really fully owning what I'm doing. So owning when I say a coffee is going to taste a certain way, owning that. When I talk about like why I care about a coffee, or when I'm on stage and I'm putting together these presentations, it's like, I'm fully responsible for everything that I'm saying. And I think the trickle down to that is like it impacts the way that I look at my day-to-day job. So when I'm working behind a bar, or when I'm training baristas, or when I'm like building a retail program, like I'm thinking about these things in terms of like I want to make sure that what I'm saying and the way that I'm setting up these programs and blah 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 all have that same sort of there's no smoke and mirrors. Like it's all just, it's heartfelt. It's It's, what am I trying to say? It's heartfelt.
It's and deliberate.
It's deliberate. And it, I think, like, you know, in any industry, there's going to be smoke and mirrors, right? There's going to be like this and that. You can say this or say that. But like with regards to the competitions and the way that I've taken away from it, the biggest thing is own what you're doing. Like, be proud of what you're doing and be deliberate with what you're doing. Aside from that, I mean, every time I've competed, whether I've done well or whether I've crashed out or whatever, I've always learned so much about coffee, about how to manipulate espresso or how coffee tastes, or, you know, I grow so much as a coffee professional in the process of training and in the process of putting together these presentations. And I think at the end of every year, I look back and say, like, whether I finished third or whether I didn't make finals or whatever, I look back and say, like, it was worth it because this is how much I learned, or this is how much I grew. And, you know, I think that's one of the most brilliant things about the coffee industry at large is that, you know, for those of us that are obsessive learners, like, there's infinite opportunities to keep learning, to keep growing, to keep discovering new things. And it's exciting. Like, that's so exciting. And that's like, it's invigorating. I mean, I get excited thinking about it. I get excited talking about it. And it, you know, it gets me out of bed and it gets me to work in the morning, to be quite honest. So competition definitely taps into that. But I would say, you know, that's one of the biggest things that I've learned is like there's an immense amount of growth opportunities, and you know, the hard and humble work of, you know, being like thoroughly owning everything that you say and do. You know, it really stimulates that for me. So
can you give us a specific example? Like, what did you learn in the 2016 competition year?
Oh man. Yeah, for sure. So 2016, I think one of the biggest takeaways for me in 2016 was learning that our perceptions of coffees can sometimes impact what we will taste or the way that we will assess a coffee. So I was working with two coffees. One, as I mentioned, one was this like super, super boutique Huila, and one was coming off of like a 1,000-bag lot from Brazil. So it was a big, big, big lot of coffee. It was lower elevation. And I think I would, you know, work with these coffees day in and day out, and like would be so surprised at how, you know, my inclination was to look at the Huila and say, well, this is better than this Brazil. When in actuality, like, it wasn't necessarily better or worse, but it was just different and had different application. Mm-hmm. And I think now, like, I'll walk into, like, my biggest takeaway from that is, like, now I'll walk into a cafe and I'll see a coffee from, you know, like a super micro lot, like super special prep coffee, or like a geisha or something like that. And then I'll see like a coffee from Peru or a coffee from Nicaragua. And I will like be a little bit more willing to gravitate towards the Peru or Nicaragua because I understand like both of these coffees have their place. And I think for me as well, like as a professional, the way that I talk and as I'm training staff, like I'm really starting to get away from elevating one coffee over another in exchange for talking about flavor profile and talking about flavor application. And I think that was like, that was the biggest thing for me, because, you know, it gets so easy in the coffee world to be obsessed with what tastes the best, what's the best, what is the best, blah, 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 blah. And even like some of the systems and structures that we've put in place actually elevate one type of coffee over another, not necessarily because it's better or worse, but because we've learned to, we've almost trained ourselves to like appreciate one thing over something else. Mm-hmm. When in actuality, like I think coming at all types of coffees and saying, you know, there's a place sort of, as long as things meet that certain specific sort of specialty criteria, and as long as, you know, I'm not necessarily advocating for like, let's get Robustas out there, let's do all this stuff, because I don't think that that's specialty. I think specialty is focusing on quality, but quality exists everywhere. It exists in Brazil, it exists in Boquete, it exists in Ethiopia, it exists all over the place. And it's just a matter of how we as coffee professionals are able to evaluate that quality, mm-hmm. and then apply it to our businesses.
Okay, so I want to really dig into specifics in 1 minute. I want to learn about like what you look for in a really good Colombian coffee versus what you look for in a really good Brazilian coffee, and what you think the different applications are for both of those coffees.
Sure.
But first, I want to hit like a hot button issue for me.
Sure.
What do you think about putting geisha in Nespresso pods?
I mean, part of me is like, yeah. I mean, you're not going to be able to really actually get what makes a geisha out of an espresso pod. But then part of me is like, well, as long as like if the farmers are getting paid, I don't know. I don't necessarily know if I have a stance on that.
Okay.
I think overarching is if putting geisha in espresso pods gets more people willing to spend more money on good coffee, and that in turn gets more money into the industry and into the hands and pockets of farmers, I'm all for it.
Okay. That's a reasonable answer.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's go back to, I guess let's start with the two specific coffees you mentioned. You have this micro lot boutique, Colombia Huila, mm-hmm. and then you have also sort of a less maybe boutique-y Brazilian coffee.
Mm-hmm.
What is the flavor profile of each of those coffees, and what do you think the application is for each of those coffees?
Great. So the Huila goes through this like very, very special, the Colombia goes through this very special sort of rinse and dry process. And every single step of that process is like very meticulously managed. You're also, the coffee's grown in Huila, which is like a high elevation, very, very well-known microclimate. And what that produces in the cup is like vibrant tropical acidity, like insane sweetness. Like it's kind of got a little bit of everything. It's got the brightness, it's citrusy, it's tropical. Like you taste the fruit. It's clean. It's intense. It is incredibly complex. I mean, there's like, in my process working with this coffee, there were like 20 different flavor notes that I could pull out depending on how I prepared that espresso. And, you know, I ended up sort of landing on three or four of them. But, you know, the application of that is like, let's just let this thing shine as it is. Like, let's let it shine as a filter coffee. Let's brew it on a V60 or whatever. Let's serve this as like an espresso and really like focus on roasting and the recipe to sort of highlight the clarity of these many flavors and that complexity. And so that's what I did in the competition. I used that as my espresso course. I use an EK43 to really like push up the extraction yield to really create the most sort of balanced and clairvoyant picture of this insanely beautiful complex coffee. And I served it, you know, espresso neat. The Brazil, similarly, was... it went through a very meticulous process as well, where it was, you know, every step from harvest to dry process was like meticulously managed. The difference being the Huila was grown at like 1850 meters and this Brazil was grown at like 1100 meters. So it's a lower elevation, completely different terroir, different part of the world. It was naturally processed versus the Colombia that was, you know, fully washed. And so that kind of impacted the flavor as well. And yet, like, you know, because of the meticulous focus on processing, that Brazil still demonstrated a very nice acidity. It was a malic acidity. So think like green grape, green apple. It was sweet. And it had a huge tactile, like great, like big mouthfeel. You know, and the application of that and what I chose to apply that towards was the milk beverage, where you're like combining it with milk, which is bringing its own level of sweetness and creaminess. And, you know, I kind of, in my routine, I referred to it as ice cream. I was like, this is like the ice cream. You know, it's widely approachable. It's approachable. It's available. Like you can get this at almost any cafe versus the Huila, which I equated to caviar, where it's like, this is like for the specialty elite. Like, you know, there's very few consumers that could truly like fully wrap their palate around a coffee that's this like complex versus having this Brazil, especially Brazilian milk, where it's like I could serve it to my grandma and she'd be like, this tastes great. Mm-hmm. Both of those things are, I would say, demonstrations of our specialty industry. Like both of them are specialty coffee. Both of them are creating an experience for our guests that will hopefully draw them closer and elevate the value of coffee. But they both are completely different with completely different applications. And I think honestly, like in our industry, we've gotten into this bad habit of looking at one and saying that's bad and looking at the other and saying that's good, instead of looking at both of them and saying, huh, both of these have positive applications. Let's figure out the best way to apply them.
Interesting. Which coffee growing regions do you think are underrated? And which maybe, I guess, do you think are a little overrated, if any?
Underrated, overrated. I think that there are like beautiful coffees that come out of a lot of coffee growing countries. I would say Honduras, probably one of my favorite coffee growing regions, might be a bit underrated. There's some like stunning coffees that come out of Honduras. It's kind of hard to like pinpoint. I think like there's a lot of cool stuff happening in Peru and Bolivia and Ecuador, and those may be kind of underrated coffees, just but more so because people are a little bit, maybe they just are less experienced with them. I think there's cool things happening in places like Myanmar, where coffee is starting to come out of Myanmar that could potentially be as good as anywhere else. I'm like dying to taste good Myanmar coffees and cut Myanmar coffees, because I think, you know, you look at the climate there and like, yeah, there's huge opportunities. As far as overrated, I mean, I don't want to step on any toes, but like the geisha thing is great and has been really great for the conversation surrounding varietals and coffee. But like, I mean, I think sometimes now people will see geisha and think it's the best coffee in the world, when in actuality, like it could be good, but it's not like, you know, I would take a lot of other coffees over some geishas out there. Now I don't want to like, obviously I think the geisha topic is a bit of a hot topic. I think, but I mean, there's a reason why geishas are so lauded. But it would be, I think it would be, it'd be difficult to see our industry become obsessed with geishas and overlook, you know, beautiful coffees that are like beautiful, like Huehuetenango Guatemalan coffees that are clean and sweet and citrusy and lovely. Like, you know, I think that, yeah, I don't want to go as far as to say that geishas are overrated, but I will say that there is like, sometimes people will look at a geisha because it's a geisha and say, this is the best in the world, when in actuality, there's like plenty of other coffees that are just as good or maybe better.
Mm-hmm. What do you look for in a good Honduras coffee?
The same thing I look for in every coffee. I mean, clarity of flavor, clean prep, meticulous. You can taste quality in coffee when you cup it. I mean, clean, uniform, sweet. Good Honduran coffees for me, like my favorite coffees maybe in the world, come from Santa Barbara in Honduras. And those are like insane, like tropical fruit, pineapple, mango, combined with like clean, like delicious, like sweetness, sometimes tea-like flavors, like, you know, the flavors of oolong or complexities like black tea, things like that. But really, like, I think vibrant and fruit and clean are like the three things that I look for when it comes to Honduran coffees.
Is there a way that regular coffee consumers sort of benefit from barista championships, other than, I guess, maybe having better baristas in their coffee shops? What can regular people take away from these competitions, or what can they learn from them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, for people to watch, like, I think about my mom sometimes. Like, my mom watches like all my competitions, and she like loves to support me in that, which is wonderful. She doesn't taste the coffees when she's watching, and she doesn't necessarily understand the connections between like what I'm doing and how that makes the coffee taste. But she can look at that, and I'll use her as an example, but anybody can watch a barista competition and see passion and listen to stories and feel a bit more drawn to the coffee world. You know, I think coffee for a lot of people is still a commodity. It's still looked at as like, you know, prepackaged meat versus being something that's like agriculture and beautiful. And so for somebody who kind of looks at coffee that way, to maybe be a fly on the wall at a barista competition and listen to baristas talk, you know, very vividly and passionately about why what they do matters and why the coffee they're serving matters, I think it can definitely begin to sort of redefine what coffee is in people's minds. And I think that that's like incredibly important. I mean, I think that might be the most important work that coffee professionals working in cafes, like barista and customer-facing coffee professionals, can be doing right now.
You obviously ramped your skill set up in a incredible rate, going from not really being in the coffee industry to competing in the first 6 months and winning. Do you have any advice for people in the Angels Cup community who are sort of working on developing a sharper sense of taste?
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing, and this is what I tell people when I'm doing barista trainings, is like, we've been tasting like as long as we can. But like, tasting is one of the things that we have been doing, like, assuredly before we can remember. Like, before I can remember, I was like putting things in my mouth and either eating it or spitting it out, depending on how it tasted. And I think like, we are way better at tasting things than we give ourselves credit for. And so I think that there's a lot of power in terms of just tasting as much as you can possibly taste. But when you taste things, remember, like, I'm actually good at this. Like, I actually know like what tastes good and what tastes bad, and I know balance and all that type of stuff. Really, like, the work of learning how to taste and talk about coffee is not necessarily the tasting part, but it's figuring out how to talk about it. It's putting handles on flavor notes or putting a vocabulary around describing the way things are interacting with our senses. And so I think developing a sharper sense of taste, I mean, taste everything. Taste fruit, taste food, taste beer, taste wine, taste everything, and begin to sort of focus on a way that you describe each thing. Like, if you're, you know, even if you're like sitting at a restaurant and eating bread, like, what does the bread taste like? Is it like, describe it, like, describe it in your mind. Like, those types of exercises will begin to sort of create the habit of evaluating complexity and evaluating flavors and how they combine. Because I think we already do that, right? We like, we do that when we sit down and we eat something and we like it and we'll eat more of it. But I think just the active like mental process of thinking through, what is it that I like about this? Why do I like it? Et cetera, et cetera. And I think also putting yourself like asking, you know, going to coffee shops and tasting coffees and asking, like, feeling like free to ask baristas, like, what do you think of this? Like, what do you taste when you taste this? Because I think, you know, 9 out of 10 baristas would be interested in engaging that type of conversation. And I think, you know, in my experience as a barista, very rarely do I have a customer come up and ask me, like, especially after the fact or like while they're drinking it, like, like, what do you like about this? And so, you know, feeling comfortable engaging. And once again, that applies to everything. I mean, like, that applies to food, that applies to like going to the cocktail bar, that applies to beer, that applies to anything. I mean, I think we're in such a place now with sort of this like artisan movement happening in across the country, where like we can most likely find a place that really cares about what they're doing, whether it's charcuterie or wine or coffee. And I think taking advantage of the people who like live and breathe that by asking them, like, you know, how do you taste this? Or what is your experience with this particular wine or product like? You know, that's only going to help, once again, build that vocabulary around how we talk about taste and how things connect.
That's a good segue into our next set of questions.
Perfect.
So now you're working for a bakery called, I'm going to mess this up again, Tartine?
Tartine, yep, that's it.
Tartine, excellent. Yeah. Okay. Can you talk about what Tartine is and how you got involved with them?
Yeah, for sure. So Tartine is based in San Francisco and is a tiny bakery on the corner of 18th and Guerrero in the Mission in San Francisco. And Tartine is probably one of the most well-known bakeries in the world. It's known for incredible quality across the board. And really, like, what Tartine is known for is the bread. So they make this bread, and they make it every day, and it literally is, it's, in my opinion, the bread to rule all breads. I mean, it's like, once you have Tartine bread, it's hard to find something that compares to that flavor experience.
Can you describe it for us?
Absolutely. I mean, it's like the number one word that I use to describe what it's like to taste Tartine bread is that it is alive. Like, you taste it and it's like, it's alive. Like, it is, there's tartness from the fermentation of the dough. There's this incredibly like gooey texture. It's like sweet, and it's, you know, the way that the taste experience, like, from start to finish, especially if you get it while it's hot. I mean, one of the best meals I had last year was a hot loaf of Tartine bread in Dolores Park, and just like ripping off these hunks of this bread and just eating it, just plain bread. Cause it's crispy and crunchy and it's soft, and it's like pillowy texture on the inside. It's chewy. It's sour from that fermentation, but you know, you can taste the quality of the grains, and I mean, all of these different sorts of like articulations of flavor and texture, just work together to create this experience that's like, it's alive. It's crazy.
What's your favorite grain for bread?
I just like the plain like country loaf. I mean, I think, you know, they do a bunch of different types of things with grains. And I mean, I'm a fan of just the country loaf with wheat. You know,
and what sort of styles do they have? Is it just, do they just make like a loaf of bread, or do they have like different styles?
They do a lot of different things. They'll integrate different seeds or different, like, well, there's walnuts or olives. It changes every day, and it depends on the types of heirloom grains that they can get. So then the grains will change as well. And then they'll do baguettes, and you know, they're kind of always pushing themselves to get better. I mean, the baking team there is like, you know, you listen to them talk about bread, and it kind of like makes you question what you're doing with your life a little bit, which I appreciate a lot. But yeah, I mean, anybody that's in San Francisco or near San Francisco that has yet to experience like Tartine bread, I mean, go today. Get some. it will change the way that you look at, like, it changed the way that I look at food. Like, to taste something like that, something that at one time might have been just so commonplace, and now is just like, it has become so elevated. But along with the bread, they also do a bunch of they do croissants, and they do tarts and cakes and stuff like that, that are all like everything. Like, there is not one thing that they offer that is not the best in class, like the best that I've had in that category.
Oh, I love croissants.
Yeah, I mean, these are epic. And it, you know, honestly, what it comes from is it grows from this like insane attention to quality and an insane attention to detail. And just being unswerving from that, like wanting to constantly like push yourself to get better, to be better, to not even to be the best for the sake of being the best, but just to make the best thing that you possibly can make, you know, which is it's wonderful, tied with this sort of like very utilitarian values of just doing the simple things as best you can.
If you had to pick like one or two things that really separate their process from the process of other bakers, what do you think it is?
I mean, I don't necessarily know if I can speak to that with like much with too much knowledge, but from what I've observed, and not to sound like too like cliche or whatever, but it's just they care so much. Like, they are obsessed with bread. Like, they why is the bread so good? Because like, they have spent millions of hours thinking about it, thinking about ways of improving it. And it's tweaking the recipes, it's tweaking the fermentation times, it's tweaking the grains, it's all these tiny little things. But at the end of the day, like, you're dealing with like basic ingredients like water and flour and salt and yeast. And like, you know, the amazing thing about that is that like the minute sort of manipulation of maybe this much time or maybe this much time or this much water or this whatever, like they've just put the time in. I think like you can't necessarily say that putting time in is a process or ingredient, but I think it is part of the recipe. It is part of what has made that so successful. And what that grows out of, I think, is just it's passion and care. Like they want the bread to be the best it can be. And I mean, and that applies to anything. I mean, I think there's coffee people that would say the same thing. I mean, like I deal in two ingredients, coffee and water, and milk. And you know, like the potential for good or bad that can come out of those two ingredients is immense. And the more I care and the more time I put in and the more I focus and really like push myself to want to continue to like create the best articulations of those two ingredients, you know, the better coffee gets.
So this might be a weird question, but so you mentioned that there's a few ingredients in bread.
Mm-hmm.
Are people who are obsessed with bread as obsessed with those ingredients as people who are obsessed with coffee or obsessed with the ingredients? They have like different, I know in beer making, they care a lot about the varietal, not maybe not the varietal, maybe the species of yeast.
Uh-huh.
Do they have the same thing in bread making?
Absolutely. Everything. The type of salt, the type of flour, the water, where the water is coming from, what the water is like made up of.
The type of flour, or do they have like flour origins?
Oh, absolutely.
Are there, like, regions that grow?
Totally. And there's ancient origins and there's the way that the flour is milled. I mean, very similar to coffee, like there's all of these different levers that you can pull in the supply chain that will alter the way that something tastes or the way that something articulates flavors or works with the starter. I mean,
So which regions have the most unique flowers?
Yeah, I have no idea, to be honest. Like I've yet to go quite that far down the rabbit hole.
Okay.
But like, I definitely know like Chad and Richard who oversee the bread department, Tartine. Chad's one of the owners, but they would definitely have a lot to say about flour. I mean, they could probably talk, as long as I can talk about coffee, they could probably talk about flour times 10.
Interesting.
But yeah, I mean, the rabbit hole is deep. Like the rabbit hole is deep. And I think, to be honest, like that's one of my favorite things about Tartine is that, and it's one of the my favorite things about being able to work in that environment is that, like, they have somehow taken something that is at one point was so commonplace, like, yeah, there's bread in every restaurant and they give it to you for free, and have made it into something that is absolutely extraordinary and like will redefine the way that you think about that product. You know, and I think there's something very, very special about that, especially when you're dealing with something as humble as bread. You know, like when you have a great meal, like very rarely will you think about the bread. But when you have a great meal with Tartine bread, the bread makes everything so much better. And I mean, we're talking about like a, you know, bread is a sustenance. It's a staple. It's like in certain places, it's in every home. And, you know, I think, to me, like looking at that and looking at the way that they approach bread and taking that same sort of mentality and applying it to what I do, to coffee, which to be fair, you could draw a lot of parallels between the two. You know, it's been incredibly inspiring.
Interesting. Okay, so now you are working on sort of a new project within Tartine. To roast coffee.
Yep.
And that, as we said, is called the Manufactory.
Yeah, coffee manufacturing.
What is your philosophy there? And I guess sort of what's going to differentiate that from other coffee roasting operations?
Yeah, so very similar to sort of how Tartine approaches everything, like we want to approach coffee in the same way. So we are, you know, we want to keep it as simple as possible while executing in terms of flavor and roasting. We just want to do everything the best that we can do it, and we want to be better tomorrow than we were today. And I think that is just like on a base level, like that's kind of the driving mantra. It's like we want to find really great coffees and we want to roast them exceptionally well, and we want to deliver that product in a way that in beautiful spaces made by expert baristas that are all sort of rallying around this idea of like, let's continue to like learn, grow, and get better. And so in the end, it's like it's not any necessarily any different than what anybody else is doing, aside from the fact that we, you know, have the opportunity to sort of partner with Tartine and sort of rebuild the like what, you know, coffee can look like in a bakery setting, what coffee and food mm-hmm. could look like in restaurant settings and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, a lot of this stuff now is just like we're just getting off the ground. So we're sort of in this like dream stage where we're trying to figure out exactly what that looks like. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, very similar to what you'd experience, you know, walking into your local cafe, like we just want like very friendly, hospitality focused, super skilled baristas making really tasty coffees that we are obsessing over roasting and sourcing properly. And you know, every step of the process, we're putting in the time and the passion to make sure that you know, quality is not lost.
So more specifically, what about being in a bakery is sort of influencing your decisions when you maybe source coffees or roast them? Like what influence is that having on you?
Well, we definitely look at it like, you know, people that come into the bakery are going to be getting food, and coffee is kind of going to go along with that. Like, I think that there's, you know, when people come into Tartine, they're not going to stand in line, you know, for a half hour or whatever and just get a cup of coffee. They're going to want to get pastries and food. And so that definitely does inform the way that we're roasting and the way that we're making coffee. Like, you want to kind of put it in that proper context. But at the same time, I mean, we want to be true to sort of the origins. We want to be true to the coffees, and we want to do something that for us is like demonstrating super high quality. And so, you know, it's kind of balancing those two things, right? Like understanding, it's like we were talking about earlier, it's like understanding the application and then creating a product that kind of will both fit that and also like enable us to kind of, you know, put out something that we're proud of and passionate about. Mm-hmm. And so what we're working with now is that we've developed two blends that are going to kind of rotate seasonally. One that is sort of we've more or less designed to be the espresso base, and one that we've sort of designed to be our sort of filter coffee base. And those are, you know, multi-origin blends that are, you know, incredibly balanced and super delicious, and you know, create for the people that are coming into the bakery, creates this like beautiful pair with the food that we're doing in the bakeries.
What's your target flavor profile for those two coffees?
Honestly, more than anything else, is just balanced. Like, we want something that's sweet, that's acidic, but not overpowering. That's sweet but not flat, and that has a good interchange between those two things. And okay. I think we've nailed it. Like, we've got these two blends now that we've been working with for the last like 2 months or so. And you know, we've gotten great feedback, and that's kind of where our starting spot was. From there, we're starting to get more into working with sort of origin focused coffee. So we have a couple coffees from Ethiopia. We've got Washadamo, and we've got a Ucro, and we're going to start rolling out, you know, single origins here and there as we feel necessary. But we're going to keep the, you know, very similar to sort of the ethos of Tartine, we're going to keep the offering sheet pretty tight, pretty small. And once again, just focusing on doing the highest quality thing the best we can do it.
Are you bringing those single origins in with a specific purpose in mind for them?
Generally, yeah. I mean, we just want, you know, to be able to offer a sort of origin-focused experience. I mean, you taste a blend that's made of Colombia and Peru, and you put that next to something like Ucro, like there's going to be an incredible difference in the way those two things taste, obviously. And being able to offer that experience to our guests is something that we want to do. You know, and as I mentioned, I mean, we're still kind of forming a lot of this, but it's going to be cool to see how we can kind of reimagine the way that we talk about single estate and single origin coffees and reimagine the way that we talk about blends. Because, you know, over the last like 5 years or so, blends have kind of become this like almost like a dirty word. Like, people don't want to drink blends. They don't want to appreciate blends. necessarily as much as like more origin focused stuff. And it makes sense. Like it makes sense to like want to experience the terroir and experience the what makes these different coffees unique. But I think that there's, you know, once again, in the application of the day in, day out of putting coffee in a bakery, like, you know, you want to create something that, that is, that has wide, that will have wide appeal, but also begin the process of sort of redefining what coffee is and what coffee can be.
Do you think that you could win a barista competition with a blended coffee?
Yeah, it's been done. It's kind of an older school model, but it's definitely been done. You know, the distinction that you lose with a blend, like, you know, barista competitions lend themselves to like these very distinct coffees. So like coffees that taste very, that have like clean profiles and distinction. And I think with blends, you may lose that a little bit in exchange for just round, sweet, and balanced. And so, you know, I think back in the day when the score sheets were mostly taste balance and not as much like flavor notes driven, like you used to see people, I mean, people would win with blends. But I used that. I used a blend when I was in 2015 at the regional. I used a blend and I did well. I finished in top six. And
yeah. What was the blend of?
It was a couple. I used two Guatemalan coffees. And then I used like two Guatemalan coffees for my espresso. I used one Guatemalan coffee for my signature beverage. And then I used a Brazil, a Panama, and a Guatemala for my milk beverage.
Interesting.
So once again, understanding the applications and figuring out how to create something that knocks it out of the park within that, I think is an important part of all of this. So.
Okay, so we're moving into the closing questions now.
Okay.
What do you think, or what do you wish that every coffee drinker knew about coffee? And are there any myths that you would like to dispel?
I think the biggest thing, and this is like if you're looking at coffee drinkers as a whole, the biggest thing is like coffee is agriculture. Like it's produce. Like I think that is one of the biggest, like for me when I say that to myself, I'm like, whoa, like that, it changes the way that I look at it. And because coffee has become so, has gone like so far away from that, you know, it's like, and part of the reason, you know, part of the introduction to coffee, like way, way, way back in the early days of coffee in the States in particular, was like, it was this incredibly exotic product that went through this incredible process of commercialization. So it was commoditized, right? So people would go and they'd buy a can of this brown powder, and that was coffee. And there was very little links made between that brown powder and, you know, a tropical fruit growing on a mountain, right? Like, and even very rarely do most, like, everyday coffee drinkers look at coffee and think tropical fruit growing on a mountain, when in actuality, like, that's what it is. And so, you know, that's definitely something that I enjoy kind of interacting with or engaging when it comes to talking with people who are in food or chefs. Like, yeah, you know, you should, like, coffee should be approached and looked at like produce, because that's what it is. It's agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
As far as myths go, I mean, like, I think that there's a lot of myths that, you know, certain types of coffees are good or bad based on price. And quite frankly, like, taste trumps everything. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have, you know, the Kopi Luwaks and the Jamaica Blue Mountains and, you know, all of this, blah, 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 that are, like, marketed really well. But at the end of the day, it's, like, taste trumps. And I think, you know, just because a coffee costs $100 a pound doesn't necessarily mean that it's good. And just because a coffee costs $10 a pound doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. Like, you kind of, mm-hmm. you know, it all comes down to taste. And you know, I think that's important. I think it's an important thing, and it's a conversation that, like, I know baristas are having, and I know that's like getting passed across counters in cafes across the country, but, you know, around the world. But, you know, once again, I think that's something that's very important, that, like, taste is the most important thing when it comes to determining whether or not the coffee is good, right?
How is it that Kopi Luwak coffee is marketed so well? I don't understand. it's like a layer that you have, that everyone who gets into coffee has to go through.
Yeah.
And it only lasts for a second.
Yeah.
But like, you just, yeah. Okay. Who do you look up to in the coffee world, and who's been most supportive or inspirational to you as your career has grown?
That's got it. Let's see. I think that there are some really influential people who have been doing things for a very long time. I mean, the guy that I work for, Chris Jordan, is a huge inspiration for me. You know, he's been in the coffee world for a long time and done a lot of cool stuff. And you know, I definitely am inspired by him every day. Peter Giuliano is another huge source of inspiration for me, and talks that he's given and things that he's expressed and his understanding and knowledge of coffee and the context and cafes and all that kind of stuff. It's immense. And I think about that stuff every day. There's a guy that I worked with closely at Kova for a long time named Sam Purvis, who now owns Good Coffee in Portland. And I would say he's probably one of the people that I look up to the most in coffee. Even now, I mean, I learned stuff from him that, once again, I like have never forgotten.
Can you give us an example of something you learned from him?
I think more than anything else, like, it's just the value of hospitality and the value of creating a good experience and combining that with like unswerving commitment to quality. You know, like not just focusing on quality, not just focusing on creating a good experience, but understanding how those two things go together. You know, that was massive. Massive for me in those early days. Keith Gerke, who was one, you know, at the time was one of the owners of Kova, is now owns a company called States Coffee based out of Martinez, California, and also owns Able Brewing Equipment. Super, super sweet dude, like brought me into this world. I'm very, 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 very thankful for him and his impact in my life, in my career. Definitely a source of inspiration. I mean, there's a lot of people. It's like our industry is so incredible with such amazing people in it. Like, it's hard to name just even just four, but I think there's four people for you.
Great. And what excites you about where the coffee world is headed right now, and what maybe has you a little worried?
What's exciting about the world that we're in? What's exciting is that the stuff that we're doing today is going to lay the foundation for what happens in the next 10, 20 years. So experimentations with varietals and microclimates and all of this exploration that's happening in places like Colombia and that, like, it's incredible. New origins that are popping up, Myanmar, Uganda, DRC, Bolivia, like as the infrastructures in these countries continue to improve and coffees are able to get out, more coffees are able to get out, like, I think we're going to start to see like new coffee growing regions that are become very popular. I mean, you look at like PNG, for example. Papua New Guinea had like an incredible year this last year, like amazing.
Oh yeah.
Papua New Guinea.
Every single coffee we're getting from roasters is knocking our socks off.
Yeah. I mean, I think
so good.
Yeah. People are just like, we are all kind of in this together, like focusing on getting better and better. And I think, you know, 10 years, 20 years down the road, like, our coffee is going to be better. Our roasting is going to be better. Our equipment's going to be better. Our barista skills are going to be better. The job opportunities are going to be better. Everything is going to continue to get better and better and better. Now, what this is all contingent on, and this is sort of like the basis, and I mean, this is like the core center of like what inspires me to do what I do, is that all of this is dependent on us being able to deliver a product to consumers. Like, we are coffee people that are buying coffees to sell. Like, we, and sometimes it's easy to forget that, but once again, I mean, like, this is a business and we have to be able to continue to like expand our market. And I mean, you think about how many more people now are drinking specialty coffee than 5 years ago. It's incredible, but we still have a lot of people that we still have a lot of work to do. But to me, that's also an exciting piece. You know, as we get better at building cafes and creating beautiful coffee spaces, as we get better at brewing coffee and talking about it and creating experiences that are welcoming and warm and educational, you know, we're only going to see more people want to buy better coffee. And for me, like the biggest thing about that, like the most like incredible piece of that is that as we do that, and as like our customer base is informed and educated, and as they are sort of, as they fall in love with coffee the same way that a lot of coffee professionals do, the value of the product in their mind continues to go up and up and up. And you know, maybe 2 years ago, people would have been very reluctant to spend $12 for, you know, 12 ounces of coffee, and now maybe they're excited to spend 18 because their understood value of that product has gone up. And I think that that's like, you know, that's it's a double-edged sword, because it's that's almost necessary to continue to see this industry grow and improve. But you know, once again, I mean that like I look at my scope of work now, and I'm like, man, like every day I get to create systems and train baristas and brew coffee, and all of this is like funneling towards having more people think that coffee is more valuable than they think it is today. If that makes sense. Like to see the value of coffee go up in people's minds. And that's what, to me, that's what everything connects to. It's like, you know, if people look at coffee and see it as more valuable, it means that there's more, that they're willing to give more money that goes back to farmers. And that connects to, you know, improving the quality of life for people around the world that really need it. And I think a lot of coffee professionals truly connect with that. But man, I think like, I think about this stuff. I think about how much we're learning now, and I think about how much we're going to know in 20 years while still like pushing ourselves to learn and grow. I mean, it's going to be an amazing, amazing journey.
Okay. So I think that's all the questions I have for this interview.
Sweet.
One last thing before we go, where can people find you online or on social media, and how can we follow along with the coffee manufacturer as you approach launch?
Right now everything is pretty quiet. Like, we haven't opened up anything online quite yet. I'm not even sure if we have a splash page up. We're just trying to get our coffee dialed and get everything in the bakery, and we're trying to open this space. So you can come and you can get our coffee at Tartine in the Mission. You can come and get, we're opening a space probably within the next month called The Manufactory. That's also going to be in San Francisco. In the Mission, so you can come and find us there, and just yeah, I would say just stay tuned as far as being able to get stuff online and stuff. We're definitely headed in that direction, but we're just like I said, we're like in the infant stages. So
okay, do you have like a Twitter account or someplace where you're active online? Where I think I saw you on Instagram.
Yeah. So yeah, me personally, yeah. You can find me on like Instagram, Snapchat, everything, just DevChap, DevChap. And I'll be definitely posting a lot of stuff surrounding Coffee Manufactory, as well as other stuff that I think is interesting.
Okay. Sweet. Sounds great. Thank you so much, Devin. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks so much, man. I'll yeah, it was great.
Okay. Right. Take care.
Talk soon.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to episode number 11 of the Angel's Cup Coffee Hunters podcast. We hope you enjoyed and learned something new. This audio was actually recorded about 3 weeks ago. So as of tomorrow, the coffee manufactory will be open for business. Tomorrow being Wednesday, August 17th. If you'd like to check them out, they have an Instagram account now. It is at Coffee Manufactory. No spaces or underscores or anything, just the word straight through. If you'd like to try Angel's Cup, we're a blind coffee tasting club where subscribers get to blindly sample up to 208 different coffees every year, and tasting flights start at only $9.99. If you'd like to save 25% on your first delivery, use redemption code PODCAST25. That's all lowercase, no spaces, and that's good for 25% off. One last thing before you go. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review and don't forget to subscribe. And we hope to see you again soon. Bye-bye.